Well, hey guys, welcome to Drive to Win, presented by The Win in Las Vegas and brought to you by Mobile One for the love of driving. Justin Bell here, and I'm in the studio once again, but do you like my new backdrop? That is very fancy, isn't it? The big thanks to The Win's marketing and creative team for like bringing our backdrop into the 20th century. Anyway, very, very cool. I am just still buzzing from the weekend's race in Miami because I can actually start this week's show by not being so, presumptuous and just saying, oh, it's a Max victory. It wasn't a Max victory. So I couldn't be happier. Lando Norris took the victory in the main race on the Sunday. Now, what's crazy about it is that no one else has actually ever won the race in Miami. It's only the third year. So it was outstanding to see, so much to dig into. That's why I've got Fred Smith from Road and Track. He's the motorsport editor. He's going to join me and we're going to dig deep. There's so much gossip, so much going on. It's been 2 weeks since the last show, and literally every day I was taking notes going, this is happening. I haven't even had a chance to talk about it yet. And it was like piling up. Of course, a lot of the news, as it does in Formula One, cancels itself out as the rumors become facts and fact become rumors. So it is interesting. Something to be learned from Miami, though, which is quite remarkable, is the racing was great for so many reasons, but probably that simplest little factor that the track surface was slippery. The tire deg did not happen like we normally see. And so we got great racing, and there were some other factors involved, but that's why Las Vegas last year was so good. Arguably the best race of the year, because the cars weren't on rails. That high, extraordinary level of grip that they get under braking, acceleration, cornering, when the tires are perfectly married to the surface. When they're not, must be a right nightmare for the drivers. But for us as fans, it was just really, really good. Well, we did get what we asked for, right? For weeks, for months, actually, it feels like years, we've been sitting here saying, oh gosh, you know, if only someone else was in the hunt. And we'd been, I've got to say, Jeremiah, my producer, and I were talking about it, we've been leaning towards Ferrari as the second best team. But right now, McLaren, we had Zak Brown on just 2 weeks ago. You know, you see it heading in that direction, that they brought upgrades to Miami, and it was just a really strong weekend. It was a sprint weekend. I'm not even going to bother talking about it. Max did win that. We saw bursts of other action in it. But if the drivers don't want to talk about it, then I don't see why I should, because there was so much happening on the Sunday. I'm going to get into the race with Fred and get deeper, but I'll tell you, watching those last 10, 15 laps with Lando out front, it was, it brought back a lot of memories for me. And any driver, and I heard, you know, the commentators, DC was talking about it, is that when you're out in the front, especially when you're out of the sequence of winning races, and that's certainly Lando's issue, you know, that sort of reputation for choking at the last minute, and Lando no wins. But I tell you what, when you're in the car, you start to hear everything. You start to feel, oh, my tire's graining. You don't want to hit the curbs like you were before. The danger is that you can tighten up to the point that you actually cause yourself to have an accident. And I was looking going, please just don't touch the wall. Just don't screw up in any way. And I just could see, I could feel the tension from the pit wall. You looked at Zak Brown's face. It was very stoic, actually, and Andrea Stella. But you know they were going through just a rush of emotions internally. And it was magical to watch. I remember the last lap of the Le Mans 24 Hours. It's 4 and a bit minutes long. And honestly, it felt like the entire 24 hours and the weight of the world on my shoulders. And that is what Lando went through. But I do want to also say, remember, he has won hundreds of races in his career. He's won, hundreds of karting races. He was a winner and a champion all the way through his junior career until he got to Formula One. So the guy knows how to win races. And to see him pull away from Max, it was just extraordinary. Obviously, the reflection in the paddock when he won, the attitude from the other drivers around him just shows how popular it was for him to win. Kind of almost emotional, actually, watching Max pull alongside, just clapping like this at the top of the, you could just see his hands under the halo. All the drivers coming by, everybody wanted Lando to get that first win. I think it's going to unleash a monster myself. I think it's, you're going to start, I said all along, once he gets the winning ways back, that confidence goes up and you know you are that guy. So I think we're going to see that happen. It's just a reminder of, they're so young. He's 24 years old. He's been in Formula One. He's had over 100 and something races, and this is his first win. And just to, for that to happen, the paddock was on fire, and obviously they celebrated well into Monday morning. It was brilliant. But remember last year, they were 17th, and, you know, they've really come on strong throughout the whole year. I guess one of the things that you hear when people deep dive into a race analysis, and it kind of peed me off a little bit, that they, you know, people saying, oh, he only won because of the pace car. It was an advantage. Carlos said he could have won if he had had the same situation, pitted a lap later. Really? The way it went down was, yes, it was a strategic advantage that came good because of the pace car, but when, or the yellow flag and the pace car. But when Lando got in front of Max, he pulled out. He did a Max on Max. He pulled out of the DRS zone on the first lap. Max must have been saying to himself, when was the last time he saw that? Actually, guys, when was the last time Max saw the taillights disappearing into the distance of someone in front of him legitimately on track? And I just thought that was outstanding to see. And, you know, normally what you wait for is the car in front by circumstance, pit stop, strategy, whatever, staying out on the older tires, that Max might be back four or five places. But then he comes through like Usain Bolt at a high school 100-meter track, field and track meet, and he just catches up and goes by. That was what we were waiting for. That's what I was looking for. And then Lando pulled out 2 tenths, 4 tenths, 5 tenths, then seconds. And I just thought it was spectacular. So our top 10, the top three, I'm just going to go through those. Obviously, Lando won, spectacular. Max, really, his race wasn't as good as normal. All weekend, he was just on the back foot. And interesting to see why. They said that he hit that bollard and he might have damaged the floor, which cost him a quarter of a second every time into turn one. Well, that doesn't explain why Lando did a Max on Max. He just didn't really have the car all weekend. And that's something we got to look at. It's not that you wish him well. I mean, he is the Max factor. He is the guy that can make the difference. Just look where he finishes compared to Sergio Perez. But he struggled on hard tires in the heat, and it never really came his way. I think, as he said, if second place is a bad weekend for us, then it's a pretty good weekend. One of the things that I thought was hysterical was in the press room after he and Charles Leclerc got there first, and he automatically went and sat in the winner's spot. I mean, that's all he's done, isn't it? For 40-odd weekends, he went and sat there and then had to be bumped out and went into the second place. So it's funny. Old habits do die hard when you get knocked off the top spot. Charles Leclerc, very happy for him. I think it was an important weekend. He had that look on his face, though, guys, of someone that just can't quite work out why he's not coming together. But he did survive that. Sergio Perez flying missile attack on turn one. We'll jump into that a little bit in a minute. Had a weird weekend, did that spin, couldn't spin it back round, burnt the clutch out, had to get out of the car. How did he miss the walls, by the way, on that? We've all done it, and it's better luck than judgment, I'll tell you that. But you don't often spin a Formula One car on a 25-foot wide piece of track and not hit anything. Just so crazy. Before we get to Fred, some other news. I thought it was wonderful. The tributes to two people, actually. Jill DeFerran, very well respected in the McLaren team and the whole family there, and Angelo and Luke. And Lando saying it was for Gilles, seeing it up on the pit board. I really like that. But maybe in the bigger picture, Senna's 30th anniversary since his passing, and great sentiments all around. It was at Imola. Imola is the next race, but obviously the way the calendar's working, it was the actual anniversary. It was this weekend, and Roland Ratzenberger's very unfortunate death on the Saturday. So just an emotional-laden weekend. And what was crazy, when I got to my room last night, inside the wind, I could see the sphere, and someone had taken out advertising on the whole sphere with the Senna helmet colors. It was pretty cool. I did take a photograph. So other news, Adrian Newey is leaving Red Bull. That was gossip that turned to reality. I'm going to talk to Fred a bit about that, but it is huge news. What's he going to do? Is he going to go to another team, or is he going to build super yachts? Is he going to do America's Cup? He has projects like that, or is he just going to enjoy life? He says he's tired. I think he is tired, and I think all the kerfuffle over Christian Horner and the scandal, that really took him into another place. He is a very nice gentleman, and he's been around a long time, responsible for a lot. So we'll dig into that. The ramifications for Red Bull in the new era, the new car in 2026, we're going to have to see. He wasn't a one-man band. He did have some incredible engineers. He has evolved up through under him. One man does not control everything in any Formula One team, but that oversight of a man with his vision. Let's just see how that goes. The Hülkenberg to Audi, that locked in another driver's seat. That happened while we were away for the last 2 weeks. That is a power move. Just a couple of years ago, Hülkenberg was, he was sidelined. He was off, not racing. So what a turnaround. He's a German driver, great for Audi. It'll be interesting to see how he comes to the front. We saw some good flashes this weekend. He's quite a guy. But what does it do to Carlos Sainz in the driver lineup? His options are starting to be cut down. So I think we'll see something pretty special happening for him soon. We all love Carlos Sainz. I think he is one of the best guys on the grid. And I'd love to see him out there. You know, he won races already. Let's see him do it again. Did you see on the, if you watch the Formula One on the app, you see, you know, they do some really good features. And Alec Jacks, who's been one of our guests, and Will Buxton did that great feature on the podium with all the driver options. And, you know, that young driver, Andrea Kimi Antonelli, who's a Mercedes driver under their ladder, getting a lot of lap times. But you saw as they were moving him around, who does what? And it was actually a brilliant graphic to see where everyone might end up. And it's serious business, but there's some holes on the calendar, holes in there that people that shouldn't be there. I'm going to talk to Fred about that. But, you know it's getting serious when Kimi has had a super license applied for, which wouldn't apply to this year necessarily because they don't want people jumping up too fast. But it just shows they're getting pretty serious as they position themselves for next year. Pretty fun. Finally, the TV ratings for Miami, they outdid NASCAR for basically the first time ever. It's a new Formula One viewership record. An average of 3.1 million viewers tuned in for the ABC broadcast on Sunday with a peak of 3.6, which is up like a million from the year before. They did have a dip last year because when any sport becomes predictable, they say it even in the Super Bowl, people start to, you know, migrate away from watching the game if it becomes too much of a runaway success. Same in racing. And while it's good for Red Bull, it's not being good for viewership. But then seeing it this weekend, you get a great race like that. I bet there's even more people tuning in to Imola. So very exciting. So much to talk about with Fred. Well, it must be that time of year because we're starting to talk about the Las Vegas Concours for 2024. It's one of the world's most prestigious automotive events, and it takes place November 1st through the 3rd right here at the Wynn Golf Club. A one-of-a-kind, truly immersive experience, the Las Vegas Concours is an exhibition featuring more than 250 distinctive automobiles from around the world, paying homage to the remarkable cars of the past, present, and well into the future. A celebration of heritage, craftsmanship, and innovation, the Las Vegas Concours at Wynn Las Vegas brings car enthusiasts from all corners of the globe to revel in automotive excellence, all against the dynamic backdrop of the Las Vegas Strip. And who will you find emceeing and hosting this event? Well, on stage, doling out the heavy hardware to this year's winners? Me, of course. So come and say hi this November. For more information regarding recently added rooms and packages, you can visit lasvegasconcours.com. That's lasvegasconcours.com. Fred Smith, he is the motorsport editor at Road & Track. Road & Track has been this stalwart for nearly all of us who want to follow both literally cars on road and cars on track. I love the guys there. Went on their road rally with Matt Farah last year, which was just so fun. They're the guys that know it. He covers the world of Formula One, IndyCar, NASCAR, and sports car racing. But his personal car, it says here, has 340,000 miles on it and a badly installed transmission. So I'm not going to talk to him about that at all. Well, Fred, welcome to Drive to Win, mate.
Thank you for having me. Happy to have a good race to discuss. Happy to have a pretty busy weekend of news around the sport.
Yeah, I was thinking about that. I was thinking when, obviously, knowing you were going to come on the show and then watching the race, I was like, I bet he's thinking like I am. There's a ton of stuff to talk about. Give me a quick overview of the race, as in if you were describing it to someone that didn't actually watch it.
So the first thing that jumped out to me was that Sergio Perez had such a good start that they assumed it was a jump and used it to almost wreck his teammate, but somehow that actually worked out well for Red Bull because he slowed Leclerc from having any sort of run out of turn one. And I thought that was the race. I assumed it was over from there. I was pleasantly surprised to see the Ferraris and the one McLaren and Piastri sticking with him from there. Then obviously we have Piastri and we have Norris and we have Sainz all staying out a little longer. Norris is the one who gets lucky with the safety car. And again, I think that's it. There will be a restart. And then within two laps, Max Verstappen's tires are up to speed. Even with the older tires, the Red Bull's going to run away with this. And he never got within DRS range and he finished, what, 6-7 seconds back of Norris? It was really a stellar drive.
Yeah, I mean, I love the way that you summed it up, actually. There is, I thought at that beginning, first of all, do you know Max said he thinks he felt him touch the back of the car? He think he felt him. There's a scratch on the rear of the car that can only have come from Sergio. I mean, that shows the state of play that we're in. We're all going, well, if he takes Max out, we're going to have a race. You know, that's how we're thinking about it. Although that I also thought that will literally be the nail gun in the head of Perez's Red Bull seat. I did also feel that. But you're right, isn't it? We're looking for the anomalies, Fred, that allow a race to happen. But every time one of those came, it reset to a level playing field. I think even McLaren were probably surprised by the pace that they had.
And their qualifying pace wasn't all that impressive, especially having two qualifying sessions this weekend. None of the four opportunities they had were higher than fifth. Mm. I didn't think that car had this clean air speed. I certainly didn't think it had the opportunity to get up to speed off a restart like that. But Norris had everything he needed. Piastri, even in the less upgraded car, had enough to fight with the Ferraris head-to-head. Obviously, that didn't go great, but I don't think that had too much to do with the upgrades. I think that had a lot more to do with the one passing corner on the track's runoff area shape and his aggression after being blocked one time.
Yeah. The way they're running side-by-side, teammate to teammate, I mean, we saw it from more than one team, didn't we, in this race? There's a sense, I mean, I tell you, I've driven on street circuits. You know you've got to make your move when you got the opportunity. And it's so tight to overtake. It makes for stimulating racing for us. Nerve, nail-biting reactions from the pit lane. But it does also show just how at every level down the field, nearly every level, everybody is... They're such accomplished drivers, so young. They've all won so many races on their way to deserving a seat in Formula One. It's almost their only chance to shine for a lot of them, that opening lap. And yet, most of the time, they don't touch. Do you enjoy that element of it, seeing these young guys getting all sporty?
There was a particular battle early in this one that we've seen a few times already over the past few years between the Alpine teammates that really stood out to me.
Yeah.
Those guys' willingness to go side by side with each other, personal history aside, the discussions about how Ocon was and feels about having Gasly brought in aside, I am always amazed how much respect they have for each other when they're going side by side in teammate cars, knowing what happens if they touch. There is so much aggression there, and yet there's so much of an understanding that we cannot wreck each other. And you see that go all the way up to the Red Bulls at the top. And, you know, Checo Perez, he knows he's probably not going to be in this car much longer, even if he gets another season or two. And he knows even when he's in this car, not every race is a race he can win. So if he can get out ahead and he can get into second with that move without wrecking his teammate, it was brilliant. And if he messes it up a little more, it's an all-time mistake. He feathers right in between and comes out with basically the same outcome.
Yeah, it was as everyone moves left. I mean, you look at his in-car, you could see as, you know, it's wide open for him to go down the inside. And he was just mighty lucky he didn't collect, you know, the Ferraris as well behind. But you do have to be that opportunistic. You really do. And standing starts give you the chance to, I've said it on the show before. I mean, you could be sixth on the grid and second into the first corner if you get a good, good start. One of the things that I always am blown away by, and it, I asked Zach Brown about it 2 weeks ago. Max off the line, it's not a technical advantage. It's not the car being better than anyone else. Off the line, these cars are pretty much identical. I just keep waiting for someone else to have a better start than Max, and they really don't. I mean, they really don't, do they? Why don't they?
And that's one of the things you really see every time he and Leclerc qualify so close to each other. Their qualifying pace is so similar. Leclerc has that one lap speed. But you get into the racecraft, and from the literal very beginning, it just looks like Max is on another planet.
Yeah, it's wild. So we've got this situation. I mean, I said it on the show last week, how Ferrari probably are the number two team. McLaren now probably arguably right there for them. Do you think McLaren can maintain this pace going into Imola? What do you think? You've seen a lot of drivers, and as you see it across all the forms of racing you cover, when someone gets those winning ways, Fred, it changes something.
And this is actually the column I wrote yesterday about Lando. All of a sudden, out of nowhere, he has a real opportunity to be the guy who fights Max now. Mm. If these upgrades are competitive at other tracks, certainly we saw before this car was upgraded, it was surprisingly competitive in its past race. Certainly was a winning car here. And now at Imola, I think this is actually a track that benefits the car more than Miami might have compared to the Red Bull. And if they're competitive there, maybe not even winning, but just, you know, within 2-3 tenths of the Red Bull on race pace, that's an encouraging sign that this is a lot more to grow. Maybe there's more upgrades to come. Maybe there's more comfort to find with the car. And then maybe once Austria gets used to these new upgrades, maybe they're the team that's not just fighting Red Bull for second, but they're the ones that are winning enough races that I don't think this is going to be necessarily competitive down to the wire, but maybe it's not a 150-point runaway this year.
Yeah. I mean, I've always said you put someone under pressure, you start to see a different dynamic. And these guys have all raced each other all the way through in karting, so they all know each other very well, and they're all so good. But Max would really like more of a fight. I mean, even Lando said out front it got a little bit boring. I always waited for him to say the second part, which is it got a little bit boring. And now I know how Max must feel, but he didn't actually say that. But let's move to Red Bull, because so much happening there. Is the Adrian Newey news that he is leaving going to signal a decline for Red Bull as they're getting ready for the 26 car? I mean, that's the $1 million question, isn't it? Maybe $1 billion question.
So they're probably fine for 25, just the advantage they have, how little time there is to change. But we also thought Mercedes would be fine for 21, and Red Bull caught them. But the bigger news, less so than Newey, is all the people who will leave underneath him, both the people who always wanted to work with Adrian Newey and the people who we've never even heard of, who aren't on television, who are part of that salary cap budget number. All of those people now are seeing, you know, the tops leaving. Yeah. There is a crisis here.
Yeah.
And maybe even Max is considering leaving by 26. Is this still where I want to be? Especially when you look at how much money Sauber is going to have once it becomes Audi. Mm. You look at the hiring that's happening at a team that's not even necessarily on the grid until 2028, if ever. And then you're saying Adrian Newey might go to Ferrari, might go to Mercedes, might go to Audi, might even go to that Cadillac program. Maybe even Alpine decides that suddenly it wants to be more competitive and makes a godfather offer we don't see coming. At that point, Red Bull's the last place you want to be. And we don't even know who their number two driver is next year, let alone who their number one would be if Max left.
I mean, great. Well put. I mean, the other part about it is with Mercedes really confident. Some articles came out last week about how confident they are in their engine program for 26. And we could see that Mercedes era of domination. Lewis could be arguably leaving at the wrong time. I think Ferrari are going to be pretty strong anyway. But yeah, I mean, Jonathan Wheatley, who's the Red Bull sporting director, he is casting around for a possible team principal opportunity. So, you know, you're right. A lot of other people might leave, but Red Bull still is going to be the place to be for the next 18 months, for sure, even if it tightens up.
And there's no world in which they fall out of contention.
No.
Even if somebody catches them, it's just not going to happen. As we saw with the Mercedes, the rules were changed entirely to go away from benefiting its drag package. And still, even with the Red Bull being much benefited, it was equal. And it was completely equal. Lewis Hamilton was still able to win far more races than anybody but Max Verstappen has won in any season since combined. Mm-hmm. And that's with a teammate in Valtteri Bottas, who wasn't exactly comfortable developing a car anyway. Didn't have a huge history of doing that at the time. He was only in his however many season with Mercedes at the time. Now, obviously, at Sauber, he's got a little bit more experience with a smaller team where he's more important as focus. But now Hamilton and George Russell, you have a driver lineup there that you would think would be great to develop a 26 car. But of course, we know Hamilton is leaving, and we know that the discussion of who's going to replace him is not exactly focused on people who would be a number two to George Russell. And that has me worried about maybe they're thinking too far ahead. Maybe they're not really thinking in a plan where they're developing a 2026 car through the 2025 season so much as they are developing a 2026 car starting now. That engine program is going to be great. They have the best engine program. Red Bull, of course, has built a pretty strong engine program of their own and will be in great shape for that. But then you look at the customer cars that are also going to have that Mercedes engine. I doubt that Mercedes is going to be quite so kind in giving a great engine to McLaren and giving them the full toolbox with the ECU to build everything they need. But McLaren still has been able to build a competitive car now and will have a strong engine from Mercedes. Williams is going to have a huge opportunity to build this new car, first really developed under this new cap rules. And they're going to have an opportunity to potentially solidify their own lead driver lineup, keeping Alex Albon, because it doesn't look like he's necessarily going back to Red Bull anymore. And maybe both Red Bull and Mercedes aren't necessarily the place to be. Maybe there's all these other opportunities that are going to have a strong engine and a huge chance to build their own car. But ultimately, Red Bull's won all but three races, all but four races in the past 25-ish months. So,
yeah, I mean, I think that the Williams thing for Newey is maybe an outlier, right? He started out there. He did so well in the 90s. He had a bit of a fractious departure with Patrick Head and Frank Williams over, you know, just, I guess, creative control and things and not being involved in the driver picks and stuff. It was a bit fractious when it ended. But what a nice way to go back. I mean, Williams, the viewers who are only Drive to Survive newbies to our sport, they've just looked at Williams as also runs at the back. But they were the dominant team for a long, long time with many, many wins. And what a nice full circle it would be to see Adrian Newey go back there. Maybe, as they say, take a stake in the team, which would be pretty lucrative the way these franchises are becoming more valuable. But the other part of it is maybe he just wants to retire and enjoy life. Because, I mean, he's in his late 60s and Formula One is quite a pressure. And I don't think he needs the money. But the domino effect, the magic of his name when it's associated with any part of the new car development, it seems that there is a golden touch there. And maybe it's just as simple as he knows how to motivate the right people and they feel inspired. But I think we're going to see, as much as where Carlos Sainz goes to drive and where Lewis, you know, where Max might end up, where Adrian goes, I think we'll supercharge whatever team that's going to be.
And if it's a team like an Aston Martin, and if it's a team like a Williams, it changes your future outlook completely because there's this halo effect with hiring. Everybody wants to work with Adrian Newey. Everybody knows his record. And if you're at Williams and Adrian Newey is back at Williams, and say he has an ownership stake, and say there's this now suddenly this link to the Frank Williams era, suddenly you have this ambitious team principal that's not subtle about wanting to do a lot more than what the team is doing now. And suddenly you have a driver in Alex Albon who's potentially committed their long term to work under an Adrian Newey. You're in pretty good shape to build a program where you have a say in the identity and you're kind of part of building it up. And if you're an engineer who's been working somewhere at like a Red Bull or a Mercedes, where you feel your voice is kind of lost in the crowd, it certainly wouldn't be lost in the crowd at Williams.
That's a good point. I was just thinking, as you said that, you know, one of the things about watching the drivers during the race, and we saw, you know, Daniel Ricciardo had a great, you know, great sprint race and then a terrible main race. And yet he's like, I'm back at the front, and then he's not. And then you've got Perez saying, I'm back at the front, and then he's not. Watching the way after his, you know, dramatic missile attack on the turn one, and you watch his pace during the race, now the others are closer, the delta has shrunk. And he's legitimately getting beaten for fourth and fifth place now. What do you feel that does? Because he was already under pressure. And if you're Christian Horner sitting there on the pit box, it's just not. I mean, we're going to get into this driver thing now, I know, but it's just not good enough, is it?
It's not. And it's also not good for his confidence to have races like that. He knows what his job is. He knows his job is to finish second behind Max and win if there's a problem. And there was a problem this week. The problem was that there was a faster car. And he certainly wasn't competitive, not only up front against the McLaren at the front, but with the Ferraris behind. He was even dealing with the Mercedes and the Haas behind that. He was not where he needs to be. And when you look at Yuki Tsunoda overperforming in a car, and you look at Daniel Ricciardo still having flashes like that, and then you look at the options who are at other teams right now, and you look at Carlos Sainz, and he's surviving getting doored off the track by a guy that he doored off the track a lap earlier, and he's still finishing ahead. You look at Alex Albon, if they have still consider wanting to poach him, obviously not a great weekend for him, but he has quite a strong history in that Williams. And you look at even Kevin Magnussen. Kevin Magnussen spent the whole weekend hitting Lewis Hamilton, and still he's had more impressive performances this year than Perez.
I just think the pressure is mounting in every way. He's not even going to be someone that'll be taken on somewhere else. I think he's out of Formula One if this happens. There's too much other talent around. What's your feeling, though, about, I mean, like, for Ricciardo, he knows all that technical knowledge. He knows all, you know, that's why they bring back a guy who's a bit longer in the tooth, because he understands the systems, understands Formula One, obviously hugely popular with the fans. Perez, the same, understands the systems, knows his job. But one of the things that you heard on the broadcast quite a lot is the word consistency. Now, if you have a flash in the pan, I mean, believe me, I had enough flashes in the pan and I thought I was about to, you know, be a Mercedes factory GT driver. And then you have a crappy race and you go back off the radar. Consistency is what everyone's looking for, isn't it, Fred? And because consistency wins the manufacturer championship. Consistency means you can rely on the driver for strategy. You can actually count on them be a factor in the race. And I just think these flash in the pan, one-off, brilliance shows signs of brilliance, which shows how good they really were and how good they still are. But can they deliver every week? And that is the question.
And for a younger driver, those flashes are brilliant. You see somebody, even in IndyCar, you look at Colton Herta, Pato Award, every team principal thinks, I can bring the consistency. I can make that person into a Scott Dixon type. Mm. And it's the same in Formula One. You look at all these strong races that Yuki Tsunoda has, being a relatively young driver who didn't really show those streaks of performance when he arrived. Maybe as a team principal, you think, I can be the person who makes him a strong driver week to week. But when you're Sergio Perez, and you've been doing this for as long as he's been doing this, for as many teams as he has, he's seen the very top and the very bottom of this grid, and we kind of know who he is at this point. And you look at Daniel Ricciardo. Daniel Ricciardo certainly at one point was that consistent performer. At one point, he was beating a young Max Verstappen straight up in the championship. But he's not that driver anymore. And his technical knowledge is an advantage. And we see with the recent hiring of Nico Hülkenberg, technical knowledge can be a very big advantage for a growing team. But it's not something Red Bull needs. They have Max Verstappen to work with for development. Mm-hmm.
That's a great point. They don't need him for that. What happens with Ferrari, do you think? Because obviously, I mean, it was great for Charles Leclerc. I mean, I said at the beginning of the show, he did kind of have that look on his face of what the heck? I mean, what else do I need to do? I'm third, and obviously important for him to beat his teammate. Ferrari, I love Ferrari. My dad raced for them back in 1970 in Formula One. I mean, I love the brand. Everyone wants a red car to win in a way, but it's going to be some interesting dynamics, right? Happening from this moment on, because Carlos doesn't have a drive yet. And I was just thinking, he won that race just a couple of races ago. He needs to keep his star right there in the ascendancy, because that makes him a hot, hot commodity. But it doesn't take many races dropping back 5, 6, 7 or whatever in results to suddenly not look so appetizing, because such is Formula One. What do you think he's got to do, and where do you think he's going to go?
So the interesting thing to me is that he has so much more to lose than Leclerc. Leclerc is a classic case of the young driver that a team thinks they can solve. Mm. And he still seems unsolved. Sainz doesn't have that advantage because the team's not invested in him. He needs to solve this himself. And he needs to be the one that finds out where he goes by proving what he can do on track. I think he's done a fairly good job of that this year. Obviously, he has a pretty stellar win. But that's not, one win's not enough to guarantee another drive. If you're hiring a driver off of one race weekend, you're pretty quickly going to come to regret that over the course of a 24+6 race season. So I think he needs to be consistently doing this. He needs to consistently be beating his teammate, probably not in qualifying, definitely in the races. He needs to be keeping pressure on Leclerc. And the other thing he needs to be doing is he needs to make sure that he's, whatever the group of 6 to 8 competitive cars is on a race weekend, he needs to never be at the bottom. And that's also my concern with with Sergio Perez. Sergio Perez so often is on the bottom of that group. And that's the thing that really shows that you are not the most competitive possible hire in the field if you're a free agent going into next year. I think Sainz's best bet is still probably at Sauber/Audi. He seems like a perfect pair with an older driver without a lot of personal success. That seems like something you could sell both to the company at Audi and to fans. Seems like something you could build from. But if that doesn't happen, returning to Red Bull as a second driver makes a lot of sense. If Max is potentially leaving, suddenly being a second driver there's a lot more attractive than it is this year. And there's always the opportunity that Mercedes decides Sebastian Vettel isn't coming back. Kimi Antonelli is too young. We have a driver who's winning races and available, and we should just make the hire while he's available.
Good observation. Talk about Kimi Antonelli.
I am not too impressed by his Formula 2 season, but I'm not too worried about it.
Right, that's what they're saying. I mean, he's right. He's the golden child, but he's having a pretty rough season.
Ritomo Miata, the Super Formula champion, is having about the same season. Both of them are really struggling to adjust to a very different car and a very different format. I think the difference is that Miata has nothing else to prove. He's a senior level champion, and even if he's not going to become an F1 driver, he'll be comfortable doing anything else after he gets used to it. Antonelli hasn't driven a car this fast competitively before. Now we're talking about potentially jumping him up another level before he gets used to it. And I worry for a guy with a limitless ceiling like that, you're wasting years of his career, making him adjust and adjust and adjust, and making him try to catch up to expectations in front of cameras. We all remember Lewis Hamilton arriving from GP2. At the time, he was a champion of GP2. He was there with Nico Rosberg the entire time. He was successful in that car. The expectation was that he'd win because he had already won. Charles Leclerc had already won his championship. George Russell had already won his championship. And we saw how hard it was for Leclerc and Russell to adjust for years in a slower car. Antonelli, now we're talking about potentially bringing all the way up to a Mercedes next year at 18 years old. It reminds me of how Red Bull used to do this with the Toro Rosso team. Reminds me of when Jaime Alguersuari and Sebastian Buemi were both given two seasons to succeed. And at the end of the second season, we're told one of you is going to be fired at the end of the year and one of you is going to be a Red Bull driver. Both were fired, of course.
Yeah.
It's just not a good way to develop talent, and it's getting in the way of a guy we know from his karting career really has a lot of potential.
Let's move to Kevin Magnussen now, because I was actually having lunch on Sunday with my girlfriend. Renger van der Zander was here. With his family between, you know, his Laguna Seca next week in IMSA. He won in Long Beach, so he's still out here. And he grew up, you know, he's that generation. He knows Max very well. I mean, he's older than them, but he knows Max. And his best friend is Kevin. And, you know, I asked him about the penalties. And, you know, Kevin is one of those guys. As he said, anyone comes up on Kevin from behind, I don't care. It could be Alonso. He comes up behind and he must be like, just tell me I got out of the pits ahead of Kevin Magnussen, because that guy is the ultimate scrapper. It made for really entertaining moments on Sunday for us, the way he was driving. But I mean, he had more penalties than there are palm trees in Florida. It was wild. 2 points away from a one race ban. Apparently Haas are not happy with his comments. Lewis seemed to appreciate the honesty. Like, I did what I had to do, you know, as a teammate. His driving style isn't at all passive. And he's got a place there. And do you see him staying? Do you think he should stay in that seat at Haas? Because he does provide some fireworks with Hülkenberg leaving. What do you think the score is going to be there?
I think he was a perfect fit next to Renger in that Cadillac sports car, because he's a guy who's born to drive a car with fenders.
Yeah.
He is a guy who needs something that he can hit. And unfortunately, these cars aren't quite built for it the way that the Indy cars are, the way the Super Formula cars are. But if he can not hit things, certainly he has the ability to make any driver around him a little bit wary of trying to pass into a corner, a little bit wary of what he's going to do attacking into a corner. I think that's an advantage. And at Haas, it's not something that Haas wants to hear, but it is how you have to drive the car.
Yeah.
The car, not only is it not particularly competitive, it hasn't particularly been good to drive in traffic, hasn't been great to drive in clean air either. And he needs to find those advantages where he can if he's going to beat Lewis Hamilton and Mercedes. So I respect what he does. I understand why other people would not. I understand why people wouldn't be happy with it. But ultimately, the job of a midfield driver is to fight in the midfield, and he's fighting.
And he's fighting. And it reminds me a little bit of NASCAR, in that when I did the Watkins Glen race a long time ago, and the road race, I couldn't believe it. In sports cars, we go by and we kind of let go. You know, the guy's gone by you. But they just go re-overtake you the minute you overtake them. And that's what Kevin does. You know, you go by and he immediately tries to go back by. It doesn't matter who you are. So he brings, do you know what? Someone else said it on a podcast yesterday on the F1, I think, podcast, that it reminded me of Jason Plato in British Touring Cars. And it actually did. Jason, you need I mean, I know Alonso feels he's that character, but, you know, he's not midfield. He's a dirty street fighter, and I actually do like it.
It's color that the field needs, especially that level of the field. Those are drivers that are fighting for their careers, and you see that man fighting every single time he's in the car. And that's something you need at a Haas, especially now that Sauber has Audi behind them. Mm. And potentially the back of the field is going from three teams to two. And we never know if Alpine or V-Carb, whatever you'd like to call the second Red Bull team, or even Williams, you never know what they've got up their sleeve as far as future partnerships. Maybe they're getting ahead of this idea of just a private team too. And all of a sudden, maybe Haas is alone back there. You need a driver who's willing to fight those teams. You need a driver who's willing to see a Sauber with a former teammate next to him with Audi decals on the side and all the money in the world behind it now. And you need him to say, I don't care. I'm still going to block him into a wall for 10th if I need to, because 10th is worth 1 point.
You know, when you think about that, the way they're competing, and every one of those points is worth tens of millions of dollars. And that's why getting in that top 10 is so important, getting in that top 8. And that's where he does actually have a very formidable role. So, yeah, I think you're right. It's going to be interesting to see how those guys all line up. Before we just kicked off the show, you had a brilliant way of saying, and I want to talk about Logan Sargeant. I can't remember quite how you phrased it, but the inevitable decline, actually, as it is at the moment. When I saw Logan have that wreck, you know, just clip. Who did he clip, actually? Can't even remember. You know, and go in the wall. I just thought, at his home crowd, he didn't need that. Yes, it was an ambitious move on the outside, but he did close the door. We've seen people go side by side through those corners all through the race. Is it just literally, it's inevitable, right? That the guy he shouldn't be there. Maybe he should have been at one point, but he shouldn't be now. What is your feeling on how he's performing? What happened at the weekend, and what's going to happen next?
I think the whole situation, start to finish, has been brutal. He was only in Formula 2 for a year. First, he was in Formula 2 a year late because after a stellar Formula 3 year, he didn't have the budget. A little disappointing in F3 after that. Comes up to F2, has a strong year. And because he's American, because he's got a super license and he's qualified enough, he gets promoted into that Williams well before he's ready. But Williams, I thought that was not a good hire, but I still thought Williams would be committed to developing him as a driver. If they're not committed to developing him as a driver, if they're not confident behind him, then what chance does he really have there? Like, what is he holding on to at this point if they're not going to give him the chance to grow as a driver, if they're constantly threatening him with replacement with a 17-year-old who's only technically qualified, even if he gets a waiver? It's not a good situation to grow as a driver, and it's a situation that's going to set him back potentially 5-10 years in his career if he wanted to call all the way back up to F1 again. Or if he wanted to go somewhere outside of F1, it's going to put a mark on his back as the guy who was disappointing in Formula 1 because he was dropped in this team before he was ready. He was asked to succeed immediately, and after about 5 months of not succeeding immediately, he became the scapegoat for what has now been the rest of his career. We saw Yuki Tsunoda escape this, and now Yuki Tsunoda's been pretty strong in his third year, and looks like he's going to have a fourth now. But I don't think Sargeant's going to get that extra year and a half that Tsunoda got to really develop into a driver who can consistently do that. And that's, if he knows that he doesn't have that opportunity, if he knows he doesn't have that 2-3 years to play with, I don't know what they're really doing holding on to him at this point other than prolonging the inevitable.
Well articulated. I just think that he is suffering from not just the lack of confidence from the team, but equal to Lando now being riding the wave. When you're in the trough of that performance, you know, curve, it's very hard to find your way out. And the tighter you get as a driver, the more restricted you get as a driver, the more mistakes you make. And it's just like he can't literally find his, you know, as my granddad would have said, his ass with two hands, you know, and I find it really, it's almost distressing to watch. Now, F1 Business Magazine did say that his family and friends bought $28 million, which probably is a little sweetener to keep him there. But don't you think that Formula One's getting to that point on an economic scale, also for Williams, if they want to be considered back as a serious team, attract the right people, they've got to replace him.
They've got to replace him now, or they've got to commit to him now. Anything in between is wasting everyone's time. I would be happy for them to say he's here through 2025, end of 2025. If we're not happy, we're moving on. Or I'd be happy for them to just move on and give him a chance to do something else, maybe come back in 2 or 3 years. Because what they're doing right now is they're just basically, this man has been pre-fired for almost a year now. Certainly going back to summer break last year, it's been clear that Williams wasn't happy with him. And if your team principal's talking like that in front of cameras about you, how are you going to rebuild that confidence? How are you going to get out of your own head?
Even at the interviews, I mean, Albon, they were saying, you know, and Albon is just such a world-class driver and he can win races. And I was thinking, if I was sitting the other side of the motorhome, I'd be like, are you kidding me? And that's what it's been like. It just must be such a knock to the ego. And by the way, he will never find his way back to Formula One. He should have done 2 years in the junior formula. I made those mistakes myself. And you grow too fast. Again, a warning for Antonelli. And right now, if Williams, you know, with the potential performance of that car moving forward, I just feel very sorry for him because I mean, you watch a guy drive at that level. And by the way, to anyone watching this, no Formula One car is easy. Just even to be within a second of the top guys shows you're wheeling that car around pretty well. So he's got talent, but is he a top 0.01%? No, but then who is? It's Max, it's Lando, it's, you know, it's Carlos. So yeah, I'm, and as an American, you must sit there and go, God, I do want a great American driver, but sadly, I don't think he's it.
And it also comes back to the Herta thing. We were talking about a different American driver on the grid entirely 2 years before this. His super license waiver doesn't go through. As a direct result, we get a Formula E driver whose team also, by the way, didn't believe in him and dropped him after 10 races in that car. And that opens the Williams up for Sargent. And Sargent's a backup plan to a backup plan at that point. And they're saying he's in the system. He's got a license. He's American. We can sell that to sponsors. That's enough. And that's not the confidence that's a good place to start a career from. Mm. And not only that, by not being in Formula 2, he didn't have the chance to fight for the title the next year when he potentially could have gone head-to-head with Théo Pourchaire for it. Now Théo Pourchaire is being talked about as a long-term IndyCar driver for McLaren. And as we would all know, McLaren seems to also own a Formula 1 team. And if they have an opening there, if one of Piastri or Norris were to jump, and they have an IndyCar champion in Pourchaire who's been strong there as a former Formula 2 champion, certainly he'd be a favorite to move up. And that's a stronger position to be in for an F1 future than nearly fired at Williams, because I don't believe his dream was to just be an F1 driver. I would imagine his dream was to win races.
Yeah. Good point. Before we get to the end, I want to talk about what makes a race track a great Formula One track and what makes a Formula One race a great race. And sometimes, you know, we analyze a race afterwards and go, there were elements that were good and we came out with some, you know, fun racing. Last weekend in Miami, obviously we have all the celebrities, we have the pageantry. I'm very glad, by the way, they didn't do all the sort of Rocky style introductions. I think the drivers were pretty pleased about that as well. It seemed to have balanced out into something more palatable for everybody. But the race was decent. The race was strong. And we look back to Las Vegas last year. It was one of the best races of the year. And I said it in the intro, probably because of grip levels. How do you think Formula One can manage that? Pirelli say they can come up with a tire that's a bit slipperier, which every time they drive on a track, we see drivers like Bottas really quick in practices when they're sliding around. Do you think it opens it up? Do you think that's the magic bullet, the silver bullet for Formula One to make the racing more engaging and equal?
So I think we were kind of going down the wrong path with tires when we focused on degradation instead of how much grip they have at peak performance for exactly this reason. That's the best way that we can keep downforce and power on these cars and still make them even harder to drive, still make tracks even more difficult to manage. Track temperatures help with that, but we can't go run at midnight in the desert every single race. The fact that we do it once is already confusing enough.
Yeah.
There was one IndyCar race at Indianapolis late fall in 2020 when another track canceled. And that one race happened to be the greatest race in the history of the not so great Indianapolis Motor Speedway road course. And then there's been plenty of history of NASCAR races where there's fog overhead. It's cold. All of a sudden, the tires aren't engaging. And all of a sudden, the racing is much better. We saw Goodyear flat out missed a tire compound's interaction with the concrete at Bristol earlier this year. And the result was simply the best NASCAR race in 5, 6, 7 years. These are the sort of things that happen on accident that we need to take advantage of. And I think if we're seeing slippery cars are more fun, it's always a good idea to take a little bit of sticky out of that compound and see if we can make these cars a little more fun.
So you're saying that Las Vegas, because it was in the middle of the night, all the things that came with that, the unintended consequence was the racing was great. We just need to, by hook or crook, or if you're analyzing what makes a good race, what you're saying is whatever that factor is, build it in artificially into other races.
And it's not a coincidence that probably the best track on the Formula One schedule is in the middle of the mountains in Belgium and almost always run overcast, almost always run in early fall. That is something that makes Spa more formidable, even in addition to the track already being the challenge it is. And maybe that's not going to make, say, Singapore instantly a great race. Singapore, by the way, very warm at night there, so midnight hasn't helped. That's not going to necessarily make Singapore a great race. What would make Singapore a great race is if we reduce the levels to help with that, and we accentuate what already makes that track compelling, which is the speed and the difficulty of it. And you accentuate what makes a track like Suzuka compelling, because if you have to navigate those high-speed flat-out corners, if you have to go through 130R with less tire grip than you have before and a car on your side, everything gets a lot more interesting very quickly.
Well, Fred, now we move to Imola, obviously 30 years since Senna died last weekend, and obviously some great tributes throughout, and I'm sure those will carry on, you know, into the race in 2 weeks' time. What are we going to see there? You said you think McLaren could still be quite fast at that track. I mean, carry on with their upgrades. And maybe if the upgrades are on the right, in the right direction, which they obviously are, you'll because it's a real racetrack, you actually can see the either disadvantage or advantage of any changes. The delta kind of gets bigger. Certainly when you get to a track like Imola, such fast speeds. How do you think it's going to shape up? Because I think you're right. The Max right at the front, as long as he's under pressure, that's one thing. But what do you think is going to happen from him backwards? And if they start to believe they can get off the line faster than him, if they can beat him to the first corner, if they can stay within DRS, so many things I think have become possible for the first time in a year and a half. So how do you think Imola is going to pan out?
What I'm really interested to see is how Piastri responds. Now that Norris has had this huge moment, and now that he's going to have the upgrades on his car and he can see what that McLaren can do in clean air, I'm going to be interested to see how a young driver who has, I believe, half now the points of his teammate after performing admirably against him last year responds in what suddenly became a much higher pressure situation. I'm also really interested to see how the Ferraris perform in qualifying, because if Charles Leclerc is able to get a pole and Carlos Sainz is able to start in the top five in Italy, in San Marino, in that situation, well, not really San Marino, but nearby San Marino, we used to pretend it was, in that situation, I suddenly think there's a lot more pressure to win while the car is competitive. Because the car is not as fast as the McLaren or the Red Bull, but it is competitive. And we've just seen that a car that is marginally faster than the Red Bull, if it gets out of that DRS range, suddenly you're the one in clean air. Suddenly you're the one who has the race strategy working to your advantage. Maybe it's possible for Ferrari too.
Wow. Good stuff. It'll be a great race. I am very much looking forward to it. Well, before I let you go, can you just share with our viewers what car possibly has done 340,000 miles that you own with a dodgy transmission?
It's a 1986 BMW 5 Series with a big six. It's worked on by a mechanic who used to run them as taxi cabs in Eastern Europe. He says he's seen them up to get up to 600, 800,000 miles. So mine's nothing.
It's a fledgling baby.
It's also missing all of the paint on it.
Oh, it sounds perfect. It sounds exactly what I'd expect someone from Road and Track to drive. That's great. Well, listen, Fred, thanks so much. You know, maybe when you're here in Vegas, if you come to that race, pop in the studio and we'll have another chat. Really very insightful. Thank you so much. And thanks for joining the show.
Thank you.
Well, guys, you're listening to this podcast, which means driving probably means quite a lot to you. For me, the best example was in 1998. I drove down in my road-going Viper to the Le Mans 24 Hours, competed for 24 hours, won it and in our class, and then got back in my road car and drove home. It kind of summed it all up. And I've always had that love of driving, and that is why we work with Mobile One, because that's what they're all about. A reminder that even when life starts to feel too full of screens and routines, the ultimate escape is waiting right there, patiently, in your driveway. Mobile One, for the love of driving. Visit loveofdriving.us/drivetowin to learn more. Always great to talk to someone that is so knowledgeable and such a student of the sport. And obviously, for Fred being able to compare and contrast to other leading forms of motorsport, such as NASCAR, such as IMSA and WEC and stuff, really very insightful. I enjoyed that a lot. Hope you did too. So we mentioned it. Next up is Imola. It's round 7 of the Formula One World Championship. Max extended his lead with a dismal second place, as he said. And, you know, not a bad way to go if you come home with a second. The hangovers for McLaren will probably have just about subsided by the time they get to Italy for the next race, with good reason that they did that. The questions are, will we see McLaren keep the momentum? Can Max and Red Bull respond to having pressure now? I'm very interested, again, as Fred said, to see how Ferrari are going to do in that final, you know, not final, but going on home turf, to see how they're going to respond to and react to the increased pressure from McLaren. You know, the Senna anniversary, it is 30 years since his passing. I just read an amazing book, which I'll put it on social media, but it's basically called The Fatal Weekend, and it really digs into it from Tom Rubython, who's the editor of Formula One Business magazine. It's so insightful, and it had me in tears at points as you watch and you read just what went on that weekend. Roland Ratzenberger also passed away on the same time. So, you know, a lot to remember, and a lot has changed safety-wise since then. Thank goodness for Halo, right? A lot of drivers wouldn't have made it. Ayrton Senna would be still walking around if it had the Halo, I think, in a way. 200 days until we race here in Las Vegas, and I, for one, can't wait. We're starting to see the town shift again. I think they're going to be setting this place up quicker than they did last year. But certainly every time I look out of the hotel room here at the Wynn, I can see the Formula One paddock just quietly sitting there. It'll be the epicenter of some crazy action in 200 days' time. Well, the next race is in Italy in 2 weeks. I won't be with you next week, but we'll be joining you right after Imola, hopefully with a guy that knows a lot about racing at the top level. He's an ex-IndyCar champion. I think Dario Franchitti will be joining us, so that's very exciting. Thank you so much to everyone here at the Wynn Las Vegas for providing this beautiful studio and supporting the show, and to Mobile One for the love of driving. Take care, guys. See you soon.